In early October 1981, Alice Siebold, who thought she had finally found her abuser, was asked to identify him in the suspect lineup pictured here. Without hesitation, she confidently points directly at this man. But then, somehow days later, this man, Anthony Broadwater, is brought into court, and when Alice is asked to identify the man who SA'd her, she points confidently again to the only black man in court that day, Anthony. And with that, he was sentenced to a maximum of 25 years in prison for a crime he didn't commit. But how could this happen? Who was at fault? And what was Alice going to do when 40 years later, Anthony Broadwater would be proven innocent, especially after she made millions writing books about her story? It all started with a crime. On May 8, 1981, before Alice Siebold became a renowned author, she was an 18-year-old college student walking back to her dormitory after attending a friend's party celebrating the last day of the semester. It was during this fateful journey home that Alice was attacked.
Siebold says it happened here in this 76-acre park overlooking Syracuse University where she was a freshman.
It took the writer years of therapy to vividly describe the brutality in her memoir, Lucky, published in 1999.
This is what I remember.
Alice was walking through Thorndon Park when someone grabbed her from behind, covering her mouth. She attempted to protect herself, but the man pounded her skull to the ground.
He said these words, "I'll kill you if you scream. I remain motionless. Do you understand? If you scream, you're dead."
And so, she stopped fighting back. The man took Alice by the hair to a glass-littered pedestrian tunnel where he proceeded to SA her. When he was finished, he forcibly hugged her before apologizing. "I am so sorry, and you are a good girl." He asked her name. "Alice," she said, too panicked to do anything but follow his demands. "It is nice knowing you, Alice, and I will be seeing you around." The possibility that she might see him again stuck with Alice. Her attacker could show up anywhere, at any time, and there was nothing she could do about it. A student saw Alice walking back to her dorm, bleeding, and an ambulance was called. The medical examination confirmed that she had been brutally SA'd. Alice was interviewed by police the next morning and described the attacker as a black man who was 16 to 18 years of age, small and muscular build. However, the detective assigned to her case was skeptical of Alice's account. In a report, he wrote that it did not seem to be completely factual and recommended the case be moved to the inactive files. Naturally, the police's indifference did not give Alice any comfort, and her trauma being so fresh didn't help either. "I would see a man with a similar build or hairstyle, and my stomach would clench. It felt as though I was being SA'd all over again," she explained. Still, there was one outlet that kept her grounded: writing. So, when one of her teachers gave her a poetry assignment, she wrote something that sounded like a curse that lured her attacker back to her. Weeks after the incident, she read her poem in class. "Long enough for me to see that face again. Maybe I would know your name. Come to me. Come to me. Come die and lie beside me." She called this piece conviction, a word she so firmly held on to that it would come to define an innocent man's life. And as if the curse of the poem came true, 5 months after the SA, Alice's attacker seemingly reappeared.
One day, Alice Siebold was walking down this street, and she says she came face to face with the man who attacked her.
She became hyper aware at the time. Going through her mental checklist, she noted he was the right height, right build, and had the same something in his posture. The man seemed to recognize Alice as well. He crossed the street and said, "Hey, don't I know you?" Alice felt that same feeling whenever she saw a black man. But this time, she was certain this was the man from the dark tunnel. He got away with it, and now he's mocking her, she thought. She rushed back to her dorm room, called law enforcement, sketched the man's face, and the police issued an alert.
You drive around in the car with the cops and look for him, see if he's still in the area, and of course he never is. The usual.
The search, however, didn't last long. Paul Clapper, one of the cops, recognized Anthony Broadwater from the sketch. After all, Paul just saw the suspect that same day. See, it turned when Anthony asked, "Hey, don't I know you?" He hadn't been mocking Alice, but addressing Paul, who had been walking behind her. The cop used to patrol his neighborhood, and Anthony hadn't seen him since he left for the Marine Corps. Anthony had recently returned to take care of his dying father. He had never known Alice. And for what it's worth, Alice didn't seem to know much about Anthony, the person she was accusing, either.
She was asked to pick him out of a lineup. "This is Anthony Broadwater." but instead she picked this man.
Later on, in Alice's memoir, Lucky, she shared that despite her mistake, she was reassured by Assistant District Attorney Gail Ubelor, the case's prosecutor and her guide throughout the unfamiliar world of criminal procedures. Of course, you chose the wrong one. He and his attorney worked to make sure you'd never have a chance, Gail told Alice. She claimed that Anthony and his team had tricked Alice by asking one of Anthony's friends from prison, who looked identical to him, to stand at the number 5 spot and stare at her. The truth was, Anthony was not friends with this man, and they did not resemble each other. But did the truth matter in this case? While the defense believed the case would be dismissed,
you picked out number 5, Mr. Broadwater should have been released, and the investigation should have started anew.
Anthony was ordered to proceed to the trial. The trial came months later, and Anthony was the only person to testify for himself. His friends and family did not come. When they heard that the accuser made a mistake in the police lineup, they were sure that he wouldn't be found guilty.
The people that knew me and know my character, they know that wasn't me.
We knew he wasn't chosen in the lineup. We knew he didn't have a mindset to do something like that, said his cousin Dolores. The family's faith in the justice system, however, would prove to be tragically misplaced. But how could a case that began with misidentifying the suspect in a police lineup end in a guilty verdict? On the stand, Anthony said that he couldn't remember what he was doing the night when Alice was attacked, since it was months ago. But he did explain that he had a scar on his face and a chipped tooth, none of which fit Alice's description of the assailant. Alice wasn't there to explain herself. She was attending her sister's graduation on the first day of the trial. She did, however, attend the second day, an appearance that led to more questionable moments. The defense asked Alice how many black people there were in the room to draw attention to inherent racial biases. "I see one black person," she answered uncomfortably. Then, when asked to explain her mistake on the police lineup, Alice said, "Five did look at me almost in a way as if he knew me, even though I realized you really can't see through the mirror. I don't know. I was very scared, but I picked 5 basically because he was looking at me, and his features are very much like number 4. She was given another chance to prove herself. This time, however, they made it much easier.
Siebold was asked to identify her attacker. She looked across the courtroom and picked Anthony Broadwater. That was a moment he remembers too.
Matter of fact, I'm the only black person in the whole courtroom. And I told Steve Parkett to object to it. I said, you gotta do something. What's going on in this courtroom? I didn't know that my fate was sealed.
Alice's identification of Anthony in court was used as evidence to convict him, in addition to findings in microscopic hair analysis found in Alice's body, a form of evidence that used to be widely acceptable but is now discredited by the FBI. The trial only took 2 days and ended in a guilty verdict. Anthony was sentenced to 8 1/3 to 25 years in prison. Alice felt uneasy about the trial, but believed she had done something important. Anthony, on the other hand, felt numb. He appealed the verdict, explaining that Alice's fear during and after the attack may have compromised her ability to perceive things accurately. His appeal was denied. After his conviction, appealing almost became a habit for Anthony. After all, how would an innocent man fare in prison? Initially, the other inmates targeted Anthony, believing that he was an SO. But eventually, Anthony prevented threats and attacks by actively seeking out gang leaders, explaining his situation, and even reading the transcripts from the trial as if he were in another one. Once, the whole cell block was listening to the transcript read by another prisoner. Anthony prepared for the worst and hid a self-defense weapon made of tuna fish cans inside his sock. When the prisoner finished reading, the men came up to Anthony and told him that he shouldn't be in prison. Yes, it was clear to Anthony's fellow inmates that he was innocent. The parole board, however, didn't buy it. To be released, Anthony was supposed to finish SO treatment programs, but he couldn't get accepted because he never admitted to committing the crime. He always maintained his innocence, and to them, that was the problem. He appealed a total of 5 times. Alice never knew that Anthony appealed, nor how many times he did it. She wasn't informed, and she didn't follow up. "I thought it would be a negative thing, psychologically. I wanted to live my own life," she later told The New Yorker in 2023. But what did living her own life mean for Alice? While the author may not have stayed updated on Anthony's time behind bars, she revisited the attack both through her memories and case files made during the investigation. In fact, even during the essay, she knew that she would eventually write about it.
Siebold described the attack in detail almost 20 years later in Lucky, a book that launched her career as an author.
In the memoir, Alice shared that she failed to distinguish the person she accused in the police lineup and how Gail Ubelor helped her justify her mistake. 3 years after Lucky first came out, Alice published The Lovely Bones.
The book has sold over 1 million copies and is currently number one on the New York Times bestseller list. The New Yorker magazine calls it, quote, a stunning achievement.
Throughout the years, it sold more than 10 million copies, and its success eventually got Alice a movie deal.
Her book, The Lovely Bones, was made into this Oscar-nominated film.
However, this novel was not a direct retelling of her story, but rather inspired by her personal experience. It reflects themes that were deeply influenced by her trauma, which is why the success of The Lovely Bones also put Lucky into the spotlight. In fact, when the memoir was reissued in paperback, it sold more than 1 million copies. Gail Ubelor, Alice's attorney for the SA case, even supported Alice by speaking to book clubs about the memoir. But while Alice carved out her path in life, would Anthony be granted the same freedom? In 1998, 16 years after Anthony was imprisoned, he was asked to meet the parole board for an appeal. However, after failing 5 times, he decided he'd rather wait 9 years to finish his maximum sentence than give them what they desperately wanted, a confession.
He's always maintained his innocence in everything he went through. He's had so many opportunities to just confess to it, and his prison sentence would have been a lot shorter.
But several months later, an officer told Anthony he was going home. At 16 years and 7 months, Anthony had reached his conditional release date, and thanks to his clean record in prison, Anthony was released. The first thing Anthony did with his freedom was kiss the ground. "You don't think you will do it, but I did what everybody does," he later told The New Yorker. "Lord, I'm free, and I'm going to stay free for the rest of my life." But while Anthony was out of prison, was he truly free? Since his brothers didn't keep in touch and his father died while he was locked up, upon release, Anthony moved in with his cousin. As for work, well,
the moment I stepped out, it was like impossible to get a job.
He tried applying for temp jobs, but being a registered SO and a 38-year-old with no work experience for 16 years doesn't lead to many opportunities. And while Anthony made ends meet by clearing driveways after snowstorms and mowing lawns, to most people, he was still defined by a crime he never committed.
I can count on my hand of the people that accept me in the household. I can't get past 10.
So, when Anthony met Elizabeth a year after his release, he asked her to read the court transcripts before pursuing a relationship with her. She read them on the bed while he slept on the couch their first night together. In the morning, she came to him, crying and saying that she believed him. But Anthony's fear of being falsely accused of another crime still loomed over his freedom. A year later, the police knocked on his door. A young woman in Syracuse was murdered, and while Anthony wasn't pursued as a suspect this time, he wanted to make sure that he would never be again. Anthony chose to work during night shifts when most crimes happen. He aimed for jobs with security cameras and timesheets that would provide him with a solid alibi for his whereabouts. He avoided working with women entirely. Yes, Anthony's fear of being falsely convicted dictated his every move to the point that sometimes he thought he would feel less anxiety if he was still in jail. But through the recurring nightmares and struggles he faced on the outside, Elizabeth stood by Anthony's side. They eventually got married, and although they wanted children, they decided not to. They didn't want their child to grow up to be discriminated against for a crime his father was accused of. Years later, Elizabeth heard about Lucky and skimmed it in a library. But when she tried to tell Anthony about the memoir, he didn't want to hear it. "I don't want to know," he said. "It's not about me. It's about what happened to her. It doesn't pertain to me." Little did Anthony know, this book would eventually prove his innocence. But how could a memoir that goes into detail about Anthony's alleged crime bring anything other than more pain to his life? Well, it all started when Lucky was being adapted into a film and the screenwriter Laurie Parker noticed something disturbing. Why wasn't there more evidence? She spoke to the prosecutor, Gail Ubelor, who described Alice as a kind of Joan of Arc figure with the police, how they rallied around her, and how the judge seemed to feel fatherly toward her. But Laurie couldn't fight the suspicion that Alice could have been mistaken. After all, the same thing had happened to her. Laurie was 19 when an older man SA'd her. Several months later in a library, she saw a man and froze. But as she walked out of the room to get away, he looked at her. She saw no recognition on his face. Then she realized, "I'm wrong. That is not the same person." Could Alice have been wrong too? After interviewing cops who were involved in the case in 2014, Lori realized that the only way she could allow herself to write the script was to make it clear that this was Alice's perspective, not necessarily reality. Hollywood, however, needs heroes and villains, not a victim whose trauma may have affected her judgment. As a result, the script was denied and the project collapsed. But just a year and a half later, the memoir had a resurgence as one of the beacons of the Me Too movement, and soon enough, another film adaptation was underway. This time, Karen Moncrief, who had written and directed well-received films about violence against women, was at the helm. Unlike Lori Parker, she stuck close to the memoir. Karen, however, also had her issues with the project. When auditioning young black actors who had to perform the SA scene, Karen could tell none of these guys wanted to be there. The casting directors eventually settled on young Canadian actor Adrian Walters, who had the same kind eyes Anthony had. Adrian prayed and thought for a week if he should accept the role. Then the answer came to him after hearing about a young black person killed by the hands of police on TV. No, you can't do this role, he realized. This will not be of service to people who look like you. In the end, the director decided that a white actor would be best for the role. The filming was then postponed in June 2021 after the project's financier and producer, Timothy Mucciante, was fired for what appeared to be a fraudulent wire transfer. Timothy, however, was not personally done with Alice's story. He launched his own investigation and asked his employees to look into the details of Alice's story.
Anyone who reads the transcript of the trial and compares it to her book, there's quite a lot that's omitted that a reader would look at and say, you know, this doesn't add up, just like I did.
He claimed this was the reason he stopped funding the project and started doing his own digging, even hiring private investigator Dan Myers. From there, all it took was 48 hours and they had the real identity of the attacker, along with the basic facts of the case. The private investigator, Dan, then called Paul Clapper, the cop who Anthony greeted at Marshall Street. Paul suggested to Dan that they might have gotten the wrong man years ago, especially because of Alice's error in the police lineup. I got the impression that he had been dying to tell someone for quite a long time, Dan said.
It was obvious to me that something was off because he had no other criminal history. He basically got picked up off the street and thrown into prison for this, and he still hadn't reoffended, which I thought was strange for such a horrible crime.
Next, he visited Anthony himself. At this point, Anthony was 60 and lived on the south side of Syracuse. His house was across from a cemetery and had windows covered with tarp because they were broken. Dan asked if Anthony knew people were making a movie about the woman who accused him of essaying her. It's a lie, Anthony said. The whole conviction. Even after his release, he never stopped trying to prove his innocence.
He told me he had taken a polygraph on his own and passed it.
But none of his appeals were considered. Then Dan explained. Paul Clapper believed in his innocence, and producer Timothy, who hired Dan, wanted to help Anthony. I'm on board with that, 100%, Anthony said. He claimed that his conviction had never left his mind. Believe it or not, I want to write a book. I want to tell my story. And so, Timothy Mucciante hired a production company to make a documentary about Anthony's perseverance to prove Anthony's innocence. It would be called Unlucky. He also raised money to legally clear Anthony's name and hired two Syracuse lawyers, Dave Hammond and Melissa Swartz. And as a result, Anthony's conviction was finally annulled.
Anthony Broadwater had hoped and prayed for this moment for 40 years. Syracuse Judge Gordon Cuffey overturned the conviction that had put Broadwater in prison for 16 years and marked him as a sex offender for most of his life.
But what did the woman who wrongfully put Anthony behind bars have to say? Alice was radio silent for days. She was divorced and lived alone when Anthony was exonerated, so it was her friends who were there for her. She told them that she would never write again. She tried not to look at the internet because she knew that people would only echo what she thought of herself, and it appeared Alice was spot on. She made a whole career out of destroying this man's life. He deserves her fortune. Especially for Lucky. The fact that she's made so much money knowing she sent the wrong man to prison for so long is truly evil and despicable. What a vile, racist, horrible woman. She's disgusting. You picked a totally different person in the lineup, but this poor man was arrested and thrown into jail instead, and you said nothing. There you have it, an irrefutable example of racism. Complete strangers, but they look like twins, and Karenism, using her privilege to act on a rational, overzealous pursuit of what she considers justice, putting an innocent person to jail for decades. 8 days later, she published a one-page apology on Medium with the help of a crisis communications consultant, writing, "I am truly sorry to Anthony Broadwater, and I deeply regret what you have been through. I am sorry most of all for the fact that the life you could have led was unjustly robbed from you. I chose to put my faith in the American legal system. My goal in 1982 was justice, not to perpetrate injustice. It has taken me these past 8 days to comprehend how this could have happened. I will continue to struggle with the role that I unwittingly played within a system that sent an innocent man to jail. I will also grapple with the fact that my will, in all likelihood, never be known, may have gone to SA other women, and certainly will never serve the time in prison that Mr. Broadwater did. I will remain sorry for the rest of my life." And while Anthony seemed to have compassion for Alice,
what do you think of that apology?
If it's sincerely from my heart, I can accept it.
The internet wasn't as forgiving. Online, Alice was criticized for not taking accountability for the part she played in imprisoning Anthony.
That little apology note that she wrote, "I'm sorry that 16 years of your life were robbed from you. You robbed him. It's not like somebody else did that. You identified him, you got on the stand, and you said it's definitely him."
And her apology was deemed too little too late.
Even though Anthony only asked for an apology, no, like it's not right. It never will be right. There's nothing she could ever do to fully rectify what she did to ruin that man's life.
And potentially even calculated.
The fact too that her announcement came out at the exact same time as Scribner made a statement about revisiting the manuscript and maybe adding a chapter or two to future editions of Lucky left a bad taste in people's mouth.
After Anthony's conviction was annulled, Lucky was pulled from bookshelves.
The publisher of Lucky says it has ceased publication until they decide if the book can be properly revised.
The film adaptation was scrapped as well. These decisions, however, could not undo the damage done to Anthony's life. But who was to blame? While the internet largely held Alice responsible, some were sympathetic to the author. In a piece Timothy Mucciante wrote for The Guardian, the producer said, "I do not believe that Siebold, as an 18-year-old SA victim, bears any blame. She was doing the best she could, being guided by an unethical and unscrupulous assistant district attorney. Aside from being young and not knowledgeable about legal procedures, Alice may have also experienced what many SA victims do, memory loss. Scientists who study the connection between trauma and memory have found that while victims may remember certain facts, these details are often incomplete or not in the correct order." Even Alice admitted she had trouble remembering what happened to her that night.
So did you find that you had like vivid memories of it, vivid enough to write an almost journalistic account of it? Or did you have to work to regain memories that you had tried to forget?
I would say my memory for the itself and the incidents surrounding the trial was better 5 to 7 years after the actual event, even up to 10, than it was in the first 3 or 4 years afterwards.
It took years of therapy to get her to the point where she could write about her SA in Lucky with the help of some old journal entries.
Luckily, one of the things I did right after, because I was a kind of a, you know, morbid poetic kid, was write verbatim accounts of exactly what had happened to me physically. And what the light had been like, and things like that, in a journal of mine.
But while it might have been impossible for Alice to accurately remember what happened during her attack, did she have opportunities over the years to reflect on the case and, in the process, realize her horrible mistake? As Timothy Mucciante pointed out, before Alice wrote Lucky, she had reviewed the entire district attorney's file, including the photo of the police lineup. And that meant Alice had done the same research that had convinced so many others of Anthony's innocence. So why hadn't Alice second-guessed the conviction? Anthony's attorney, Melissa Swartz, believed she knew who was at fault, and it wasn't Alice. "I've been on the other side, and I know the amount of trust and loyalty people feel for a prosecutor," she told The New Yorker. And then that person is championing your book? It's like reaffirmation that the conviction was good. Yes, Alice had trusted Gail Ubeler wholeheartedly. On top of this, the police rallying around her and the judge's fatherly approach gave Alice the reassurance she needed that she wasn't just doing the right thing. She was serving justice. This may be one of the reasons why Anthony recognized the justice system should be held accountable. "I thank the good Lord I made it to a point where I'm strong enough mentally to say, hey, it was the court. It was the system. It's not the victim's fault," he told The New Yorker. Just shortly after his exoneration, Anthony sued the state of New York for wrongful imprisonment.
Tonight, the state of New York agreeing to cough up $5.5 million to a black man wrongfully convicted of author Alice Siebold in 1981.
Money, however, can only do so much.
Is this money, is this $5.5 million, is that enough?
Absolutely not. I think that anyone would agree that no amount of money really can fix this.
But is there no way to fix what happened to Anthony? Could something be done to stop others from enduring the same fate? Researchers in psychology have been calling attention to the other race effect, which pertains to how eyewitnesses are often unreliable if the person they are identifying is from a different race. The location of Syracuse, where the attack and trial happened, also likely played a factor. Steve Williams, a black man who used to serve as a cop in the 1980s, described the police's relationship with the local African-American community as horrible and hostile. Paula Johnson, a Syracuse law professor and advisor on racial justice for state courts, also weighed in on Anthony's case. "I believe that race was a central factor in what happened here," she said. As for Anthony, he hopes his case can serve as a lesson.
"Now that you've been exonerated, what does the rest of your life look like?"
I hope that I can give some inspiration to somebody and say, hey, if you're not guilty of something, do not give in. I've been yelling and screaming and exhausting all my finances to prove my innocence. It finally came.
And yet, why did it take 40 years for Anthony's innocence to be recognized by the law? Of course, there's some guilt among readers who believe they should have examined Lucky more carefully.
Another layer of this, for me at least, as someone who read Lucky, is thinking back on me reading that book 9 years ago. If I were to reread it now, what did I miss? Is there something I missed? Should I have picked up on the fact that something was weird here?
However, in the end, Anthony was likely only exonerated due to his case catching the interest of a person with power and influence, producer Timothy Mucciante. So, what about the wrongfully convicted who don't have Hollywood heavyweights drawing attention to their cases? Is there any hope for those still in the clutches of an unforgiving justice system? The more law enforcement is trained on how to work with SA victims and how to address racial biases, the better the outcomes will be for everyone involved in these cases. And while change might be slow, it is happening. Aside from Anthony's case, exonerations have risen recently, likely due to improved DNA testing and the popularity of true crime, according to reporter Alana Wise.
There's been a much bigger public appetite, right, for true crime and promoting justice and figuring out where there's been police malfeasance, law enforcement malfeasance, and rooting out those problems.
Unlucky, the supposed documentary about Anthony's story would have raised more awareness to the public on how things could go wrong in the justice system. But by the end of December 2021, the production came to a halt. The crew had been working for over a month without pay. Timothy Mucciante's excuse? Well, among other reasons, he thought that some of the expenditures were improper. Anthony broke off the contract. "I've been thinking he was out for the goodness of proving my innocence, not knowing he had another agenda. Profit, stuff like that," he said. But in early 2024, it was announced that HBO and Jigsaw Productions are making a two-part feature about Anthony's exoneration and Alice's SA. The project is set to release in 2025. Now, one burning question remained. Was the actual SA-er who had committed this heinous crime still out there? Alice wasn't sure that she still needed to know. She was 18 at the time the attack occurred, and now she's in her 60s. To her, the window of time to make sense of everything was over. All she knows is that she will forever live in shame. As for one of Alice's biggest support systems as a young woman, Gail Ubeler, Gail may be held accountable for her role in Anthony's wrongful conviction. See, Anthony also filed a federal civil rights lawsuit against Onondaga County and Syracuse, where Gail was named in the filing. And in March, Gail was denied immunity, meaning she could be forced to testify and potentially held liable. Meanwhile, Anthony's life didn't change much after the exoneration. Now also in his 60s, he still self-imposes his curfew of 7 p.m. and only makes exceptions for work. And while having children would no longer mean they would be stigmatized for his wrongful accusations, both Anthony and Elizabeth are past that age. So they work towards another goal, buying a house.
What would your dream be?
A farm.
A few acres of land somewhere, a nice brick farmhouse.
Neighbors, old friends, and family that used to avoid Anthony and Elizabeth now invite them over to their homes. But one person has continued to keep their distance, Alice. Anthony was disappointed she hadn't been in contact with him. When speaking with The New Yorker in 2023, Alice said she planned to write to Anthony. She just needed time to confront the facts and herself. When it came to the possibility of meeting in person, Alice suspected that language would fail. We might do nothing but stare at the floor or weep, she said. For now, all Anthony knows is that Alice thinks he's a remarkable person.
My name is Anthony Broadwater. You have known now today that I've been exonerated for a crime I didn't do. And I'd like to thank everybody and everyone throughout the world for trying to help me to get along and have a better life.
While you're here, check out these other stories where the law failed people and consider subscribing to stay updated.